Welcome to the Make Lemonade, formerly known as the Niche Website Builders Podcast. If you haven't checked it already, makelemonade.agency, the new website and the rebrand of Niche Website Builders. But today, we have Robert Leonard on, and I'd like to bring on guests that aren't exclusively in the niche website game, just to give you ideas of how you can potentially expand and monetize your niche websites outside of just Google traffic. We know a lot of AI is coming in and potentially threatening organic traffic through Google, and there are other ways that you can look to grow your niche website into a bigger business. So we touch on podcasting as the first thing. He has multiple podcasts, makes his living through podcasts mainly. And we dive into things like growth, how you can get them started, if you're looking to sell, what you can do, things like that. We dive into his niche websites. He's bought and sold a few of them, started his own. He's looking to sell his current niche website, which you can get in contact with him if you want to do that. There will be links in the description to his Twitter where you can contact him about that. But we dive into a few different things he's done there. And then we go into the age-old debate, digital assets versus real-world assets. So your niche websites versus having real estate or being in the stock market. And we dive into the pros and cons of all the different things within that. So if you have extra cash flow from your niche website, you can listen to that and see if you want to expand into the real world and reap some of those benefits, or at least know what you're getting into those. So sit back and enjoy.
Are you ready to get serious about building a profitable brand online? Welcome to the Niche Website Builders Podcast. We bring you the latest field-tested tips, tricks, and strategies for building a profitable online business. We interview industry experts, share customer success stories, and reveal our own experiences working on hundreds of sites to inspire and motivate you to make something happen. This podcast is brought to you by Make Lemonade. Whether you've launched your business yesterday or you're already a market leader, Make Lemonade will help you rule your world. Head over to makelemonade.agency/show for the latest offers on our services. Let's do this.
All right, welcome to the Make Lemonade Podcast, formerly known as the Niche Website Builders Podcast. They just did a rebrand, Robert, so we're going to make sure that everyone knows. So if you listen to this, check out makelemonade.agency, and you can check out the new website there. But today, we have Robert Leonard on. Welcome, Robert.
Thanks for having me, James.
No, thanks for coming on. I guess we could call you a podcast extraordinaire. You make your living a lot through podcasts and a lot of other things. Do you want to maybe provide a little background about yourself, and we'll dive into the different topics?
Yeah, so I'm a stock investor, real estate investor, podcaster. Those are kind of the three big things that I do. I don't do a ton of stock investing these days. I guess we'll probably get into that. But yeah, real estate investor mainly, and host a couple podcasts and been doing that for a few years.
Yeah, host a couple, as in you have quite a few there that you run and make good money on. So it's nice to bring on people like yourself. I mean, I guess this show generally focuses on people building niche websites. I know you have a couple covering things like display ads and affiliate and stuff, but it's nice to have people on that are making money other ways online than just a website, and it can give people some ideas on diversification and other ways they can essentially expand their niche website into a real business. And I think podcasting is a big one too. I mean, this is the podcast now for the Make Lemonade agency. I host a few myself for my own websites, and it's probably one of the better things I've done for my own websites in terms of just networking and just having an audience that really enjoys it. So do maybe just dive into a little bit podcast for people who maybe aren't so sure about the landscape. How do you monetize a podcast, and how do you end up getting to a point to grow it? It's a hard medium to kind of for people to find you on versus, for example, someone searching on Google.
Yeah, so when you get into podcasts, there's two different paths here, really. It's kind of like niche sites, and like you said, I have some niche site experience these days, so we could talk about that too. But like with niche sites, you have two paths, right? You can go an affiliate route, or you can go display ads, or you could do both. And podcasts are kind of similar in a sense of you either, and it's kind of similar with niche sites, because with niche sites, you go display ads, you need to really scale, you need as much volume as possible to really make significant money versus with affiliates. If it's really targeted traffic, you don't need a ton of traffic to convert to significant income, especially if your referral fee or your affiliate income is high per sale. So it works exactly the same with podcasting. So if you're going one of two routes, you can go the route of podcasting being like the main business and how you actually want to make money. And if that's the case, then you really need to scale. You need to get your downloads as high as possible so that you can sell ad space. And it's just like display ads, but instead of displaying the ads on your website, you're displaying them in your podcast. Essentially, you're letting people listen to the ads, and it works the same way. Versus the other path, which is probably going to be more successful for more people, is you don't use podcasting as the business. You don't use it as a revenue driver. It's not a source of revenue per se. It's more of a marketing channel. And in that case, it's kind of like affiliates where you have a more niche audience. You're really not trying to scale to 1 million downloads a month or 2 million downloads a month. You're okay with a couple thousand, 5,000, 10,000 downloads a month on a podcast, but that super targeted audience, they're all around one specific topic, one specific niche. And in that case, you build a business that you can sell those leads to. Either it's another business that you don't own, or it could be a business that you own. You buy and sell. You sell a product to the audience instead and build a business off the back of the podcast. And so those are kind of the two different routes you can go. We, at our podcast company, we go kind of like the quote-unquote display ads route. I mean, we do have some digital products. We do have some courses and a mastermind community and some other stuff like that, but that's relatively small peanuts compared to what we're doing on the ad side. So our business model is 90-95% display ad.
Which is crazy to think about, that the sponsorship or the ads make far more than your own products, because at least in the niche site community, typically your own products or affiliate will make more than the display ad revenue, but you've kind of flipped that on its head through the podcast, which is really interesting. Obviously, companies, at least in your space, because it's generally in the finance space, I guess companies find that audience is really valuable and will pay to be in front of it. I was just talking to another company yesterday in my niche. It's generally sports, fitness, combat sports kind of thing. But I mean, what they offered me was peanuts. And I think it's just because, one, they maybe just don't know. And two, it's not something that's as familiar in that space as, say, finance, where finance generally people understand, okay, it's a high value audience, etc., which is interesting. But how do you go about selling, I guess, these sponsorship and ad spaces, or how are you calculating the rate? Because I think that's what most people struggle with, is understanding how much they should charge.
So two separate questions there is, how do you sell them and what do you charge? So how do you sell them? For us, is a little bit different than somebody just getting started. For us, if you go to the top of Apple charts, our show, I mean, it varies, but like, we've been number 5 in all of business podcasts, as as high as that, down to, we're probably like around 20, 25 right now. But like, advertisers are going to go through that chart and they're going to look for your the top podcasts, and they're going to try and find, which ones are the best ones to advertise on. And they just kind of come across us, and we have 3, 4, 5 shows that are in the top 100 or 150 pretty much at all times. So that drives a lot of advertisers to us. We also have worked with agencies in the past. So the agencies will say, hey, we have all these clients that want to advertise on podcasts. And then they also get podcasts like ours, and then they just match us up. And so we've done a bit of that. And then once we started paying too much commissions to agencies, we decided to hire an in-house sales team. And so we brought in a full team of salespeople, and now they're doing almost all of our sales. We will still work with agencies from time to time, but generally speaking, it's our sales team. So they're doing outreach, they're doing inbound, they'll work with agencies, etc. Now, if you're a little bit smaller and maybe don't have as much inbound as we do, then you're going to have to do a lot more like boots on the ground work. You're going to have to reach out to the brands. You're going to have to reach out to the agencies, work with the agencies, maybe try to steal competitors' advertisers. So like, listen to podcasts that you listen to and see who's advertising, and be like, hey, reach out to them and be like, hey, I see you advertise on podcasts. Do you want to advertise on ours? And kind of go like that. And then in terms of the pricing, I mean, really it's whatever somebody will pay is what it's worth. So, and it also kind of depends on your size and your scale. So when you have millions and millions of downloads, you can't charge the same CPM, which is what it's called in podcast world. I know it's RPM in niche sites, but CPM in podcasts, you can't charge necessarily the same. There's a law of diminishing returns here, where people just won't be able to afford it. If you're selling, let's say you're selling at a $200 CPM when you're smaller, that's affordable because you only have 2,000 downloads, a $200 CPM, it's only $400. So that's not too bad. But if you take a $200 CPM and you put that on 2 million downloads, I mean, there's not a lot of companies that can afford just that one single ad spot. So you have to bring down that CPM as your numbers get bigger. So that is one benefit for smaller shows, is that you can generally, you're probably going to have a more targeted audience. So you can charge a little bit higher CPM to make it more worthwhile for both you and the advertiser. But also, when you scale, you have that efficiency where you can come down a little bit and still make a lot of money. So that's good. So in pricing, that's how it works, really, is just when you're small, you just kind of have to find out what the industry average is. Go find out. You can do Google searches, $50-$100 generally on average, and then go out to clients, see if you can sell it. If you could sell it, great. If you could sell a lot of it, then increase it. If you can't, decrease it. And that's essentially what we do too. But we have to start, like I said, start at a little bit smaller scale. So if the industry average is 50, we might have to start around like 30, 35, and then we'll adjust on a client by client basis. If we can sell it for higher, we will. And if we can't, then we might negotiate. It's just like kind of buying anything else.
Nice. And how are you getting around? I wouldn't say getting around, but obviously with sponsorships, there's always a risk. There's a risk with the company that you're working with. Maybe they do something funny. So especially in finance. So for example, the whole FTX thing that went down not too long ago, that kind of burned a lot of creators who were pushing that platform. And I think maybe as a people who are maybe smaller creators, maybe looking to take on anything they can get, there could be that kind of risk too. So how are you, I guess, doing your due diligence to make sure? I don't know. I mean, the FTX one was pretty hard to kind of see coming, but just as a general example, how are you kind of looking to look into that?
Yeah, I mean, you can never 100% like protect yourself from that. Yeah. The only thing you could do is, well, first off, I'm not against crypto, so I don't want this to come across that I'm against crypto, but like we don't work with any crypto companies really. Like yeah. almost very few, almost none. So that alone kind of pulls us back from the majority of where like fraud, if you will, is happening these days. Like we work with a lot of clothing companies and supplements and even some car companies, Lexus, Apple, etc. Like in that case, like obviously we're not too concerned. And then like even physical products or clothing, like it's unlikely that that's going to be a scam. So we're not too worried. Like we really just pulled ourselves out of dealing with any crypto companies. So that limits us altogether. And then further than that, as the host who has to read the ad, we're able to just say, no, we're not comfortable with this. And then we won't work with that advertiser. So that's happened. We've had some of our hosts were not comfortable with reading. They're not comfortable with having their name associated with the brand. They'll do some research, look up reviews. You can see what other people are saying about the company. And if you're not comfortable with it, then we walk away. And that's a little bit, I mean, I don't want to say it doesn't hurt for us because it does, but it's easier for us at our scale than it is for somebody who's like a smaller creator and like they need that money, you know, and that's all of their revenue for the month. It's harder to walk away, but you just have to really think long term about this. And Buffett always talks about how, you know, it takes an eternity, essentially your lifetime, to build your reputation, and you know, you can destroy it in a second, basically. I'm paraphrasing, but he has a quote about that. And so you have to think about that when you're partnering with advertisers.
Yeah, no, those are good points. And I know you're a big My First Million podcast listener, and a recent one, they were talking about someone who was trying to sell their business podcast. And I thought that was interesting because obviously you have a lot, and I don't know if that's maybe the end game you're looking at doing, but selling a podcast is hard because often it's the person who's on the podcast who's the real value to that podcast. You can't just kind of replace them. So is that something you're looking to potentially do? Have you thought about how you would go about doing something like that?
So yes, we could probably have a whole episode on just this, but the one show that the listing you're talking about, I saw it come up on Twitter, and I knew as soon as I saw it, I was like, yep, I know exactly what show this is. I mean, it's not confirmed, but I'm very, very confident that I know what it is. And there, I feel like their brand is really wrapped up in the host versus with us, with our brand, a lot of times we try to make sure that the guest and the show itself is the star, if you will. And we really try to not put that much emphasis on the host. And so in that episode of My First Million that you're talking about, Sean says, if people are coming here for the host, then yeah, it's going to be hard to sell. But if they're coming here for the conversation and the questions that the host is asking and the guests that they're able to get, then you might not have trouble because you could replace that host and still get the same content. And I would say that we are kind of in the latter case there, where we have successfully replaced 4 or 5 different hosts over the last few years. And like, I mean, I took myself out of being a host altogether after a couple of years, and the show didn't decline. The two founders, Stig and Preston, they've both kind of pulled back on some shows that they were doing, and the show continued to grow and it continued to do fine. So in that case, I think you do have some enterprise value, and I think you could sell it. We have actually had some offers to sell the company, and it's not something we're looking to do right now. But yeah, I do think it is a harder medium for sure to sell, especially depending on how much the host is wrapped up in the brand. But for us, it's something that is possible. We're testing it. We're seeing how we can bring in new hosts, because you also have a lot of risk there just as a business of like, what if you don't want to do this forever, but you still want like the income to come in and things like that. So that's kind of one of the reasons why I like Niche Sites, was that like my face isn't on it. I have no affiliation with the brand. I could sell this at any point. Anybody could take it over and it would be no problem. So yeah, it is difficult with podcasting, but it's not impossible.
Yeah. And I know we will definitely dive into your Niche Sites very soon as well, but would you recommend, if someone's looking to start a podcast for their Niche Site, that they try and outsource the host straight away, just so it's an easier sell potentially? Or is it just something where you kind of just have to start yourself and then try and essentially remove yourself as you get going?
It's a good question. For a Niche Site specifically, I think it's going to be hard to outsource to a host at first, because what are you going to provide them in value? I mean, if you can pay them, if you can say, hey, I'll pay you X dollars per episode, then yeah, I mean, I probably would just outsource it so that you're not wrapped up in the brand, and if you want to sell it at some point. But if you're kind of early on in your Niche Site journey and you don't have revenue coming in that you can't pay somebody, like, you're not really providing a lot of value to them per se, in terms of like, they're not going to work for free for the most part. So it's going to be tough to outsource that or hire somebody to do it at first.
Yeah, no, I definitely agree with you there as well. Like, as well, and then also that person always becomes the face of the brand if they're on the podcast too. So they would have to potentially go with the sale, or yeah, it's a tough medium. But I guess the other things with the podcast growth, what are some things that you've found work for growing a podcast? Because it's not like, again, as we mentioned with Niche Sites, where you can kind of grow organically your traffic. Podcasts, you don't really find like that, unless, I mean, I found some podcasts where I've kind of searched a guest on Spotify and it kind of shows up all the podcasts that I've been on, but that's pretty much one of the only ways, right?
Yeah, so that's what's tough about podcasts. It's probably the hardest medium to grow. So that was the other thing I really liked about Niche Sites, was that, you know, obviously it's competitive. It can be competitive and you have to do the right things. But generally speaking, if you write a good blog post and you optimize it properly, I mean, you can rank in Google and you can get traffic, and you don't really have to, like, it's not that crazy difficult to do it, depending on your keyword. Versus podcasts, extremely difficult. There's no real SEO, if you will, for podcasts. Like, there's no virality, like social media posts like that, YouTube even, videos can go viral. But that doesn't really happen on podcasts. There's no virality, and the search is not great. And generally, people are listening to one show over and over, and they might go to another show here and there. So the discoverability just of podcasts is really, really difficult. Like you said, you do have some people who will search, who will hear a guest. Like, maybe they'll hear me on this, and then they'll go search my name and try and find all these other shows. But I'd say that that's still pretty small. I don't think that happens all that frequently, especially because, like, if you hear that person on one podcast, they probably say more or less the same stuff on most shows. So it's not like you really have to listen to that same guest over and over and over. Like, occasionally there are some people that you'll listen to over and over, but for the most part, I don't think that's not a huge driver for us at all. What does work for us are a couple things. One, being a guest on other shows. So me being on this show, people are going to hear me. They might come check out our podcast. If the niches are related close enough, which is pretty much the only reason you'd be a guest on, you're not going to go on if you're not an expert. So you can get some overlap there. That's a huge way to grow, especially when you're smaller. Second thing is, if you're in the Niche Sites, you're familiar with keywords. So using keywords in a way of, not for SEO per se, but like to make your title want to be clicked. So it's really like trying to, it's really CTR optimization, if you will, or CRO basically, where you're trying to make a title that people will click. So for me, I know people are subscribed to a bunch of different shows. I'm personally subscribed to a bunch of different podcasts, and I don't have time to listen to every single episode. So what I do is I go through every single new episode that releases, and I read the title, and if the title's interesting, I'll listen to it. If it's not, I won't. And so for us, we noticed that when we put Warren Buffett in the title, that key word, if you will, in the title is very, very popular, and those episodes do really, really well. So what we do is we try to think of titles that are going to basically increase our CTR. That's the second thing. And then the third thing, this is one of the other biggest, is to get medium-sized guests on the show. So you could get a guest on that has millions and millions of followers on social media, but if they're not willing to share the show, which I can tell you from my experience, almost no huge guests are willing to share the show on social media. If they don't do that, you're not really getting any growth or any value from them because their audience, their big audience, isn't going to see it anyway. Versus if you can find somebody with 20, 30, 40, 50, 100,000 followers versus millions, but those people that are smaller are willing to share it, it's significantly better for you because they're actually going to share it with their audience and those people will come find it. I've seen that work tons and tons of times. I've had some really big name guests on the show. And they're some of the least downloaded episodes versus I've had some people from Twitter that have 25,000, 30,000 followers, and they are some of the largest downloaded episodes we have.
Yeah, those are some good growth tips. Yeah, I've seen some of the same things. It's always hard to get guests to share the shows when you have them on, but often I'm getting people on that I want to talk to anyway. So for me, I'm just like, whatever, you know, and growth will come, and if the audience enjoys it, then whatever, and then kind of go down that route and almost like be selfish with the podcast and be like, oh, I want to talk to these people, so I'm going to. I don't really care if it grows the podcast or not. It's just I want to have that conversation.
Yeah, and that's a good way to do it. I mean, that's the way you're going to create some of the best content. That's where you're going to have the most fun. But it's not going to lead, like, that's not the way to grow, per se. Like, it's not necessarily, yeah. If you're trying to growth hack it or trying to, like, use a growth strategy, that's not one.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Sure. But let's dive into some of your niche sites. What have you got going on there? What have you got currently? What have you had before? What are you doing? What does the landscape look for you, I guess, over the next few years with your sites?
Yeah. So I have a little bit of experience. I signed a book deal with Simon & Schuster a few years back. And I wrote a book, a real estate book, and when we were getting through publishing, the book was in their hands. They were finishing what they had to do. And I started to think about the marketing and strategy side of this and like how I was going to sell it. And so I realized that I needed a website. So I was like, okay, I'll build a website for this thing. And then just while I was building a website for it, I just somehow stumbled into niche sites. I don't really remember exactly how, but I was looking at how they build a website and I just learned about niche sites. And I was like, okay, wow, this is a really cool business model and it really caught my interest. And so this was in July of last year and it really caught my interest. I dove in for a few months, learned everything I could, and I built that first site around the topic of my book, which was house hacking. Built that, ended up not really being a website for my book. It ended up being more just a niche site about the topic of my book because I was like, okay, I already know all this stuff and there's decent keyword volume here, which is, I was like, okay, let me, and the difficulty wasn't too bad. So I was like, okay, let me just create a site here. And so I built a site on that topic and I sold it in September and for almost five figures, which is not massive. Like that is not a huge sale by any means, but from July to September, just for my very first site that I ever built, I was like, okay, you know, 2-3 months, like I'm pretty happy with that. And it was to a decently sized player in this industry. If I said the name, most people listening would know who it was. So that told me that, okay, like what I just did was quality and this is, you know, this is pretty good and maybe I can actually do this. And so then I bought a site and this was in the automotive niche and I bought it. I got super lucky. I bought it and this is a couple months, this is like in September and I didn't realize how affiliate heavy it was, but it was affiliate heavy. It had one article that was driving like 90% of traffic and it drove a ton of affiliate revenue. And I think that holiday season, I made almost my entire purchase price back just in affiliates, just from like November and December, just from that one article. And so that was awesome. And I was like, holy cow, like this is pretty cool. And then I saw after the holiday season, it started to fall off a little bit. And I was like, all right, well, I don't really like this niche anyway. I don't love actually the idea of buying another site because like there's a bunch of stuff wrong with the site from an SEO perspective, a technical perspective. I know I have to fix this. And I just like building it from scratch better because then I know what's there. Like I know the skeletons in the closet, if you will, and I don't have to go back and fix all these other mistakes. So anyway, I sold that site, which ended up, I sold it for basically exactly what I bought it for. Like I think I sold it for like $500 more than what I bought it for. So I didn't make a ton on the sale. I made a couple $100, but I made almost the purchase price in affiliate income in just a couple months. So that was cool. And what was cool about those two sites is I started one from scratch and sold it. So I got to go through that process. And then I went through the process of buying one, which was cool because I got to learn that process and then selling another one. So kind of, it's not really the dollar figures that are life changing because they were really pretty small dollar figures, but it was the process in which like I learned a lot. So that was really cool. And it also opened to me this whole world of like, there's so many people out here buying and selling this.
Dude, it's crazy, eh?
Yeah, I had no idea. And then, so once I bought that site in September, I also had started a third one from scratch. So I had this one I bought, and I sold the first one, so I had no niche sites, bought that second one, and I started a third one at the same time. So I had two sites going. They're both in automotive niches, but different niches within automotive. And I think that's partially why I got rid of the second one, was because the third one started to really, really grow, and it quickly was becoming much bigger than that second site. Like today, the site is, it's only like 7 or 8 months old, and it's four times the size of that second site. So it's doing pretty well. And that's pretty much where I'm at now is working on that third site, and it's for sale if anybody wants to buy it.
Oh, there you go. Reach out to Robert if you're looking for something in the automotive niche. But it's interesting. So did you model that third site from scratch? Did you just model that off the site you bought then and just target the same keywords?
No, I thought about doing that because I was like, this article that's ranking is not very good. And this is kind of crazy. That article was 17,000 words. And it was an absolutely massive article. And so I was reading through it and I'm like, man, this is not that great of an article. But there's so much content here that I don't even know where to begin. First of all, like I don't even know how to start correcting 17,000 words. I don't know how to organize this. And it's ranking like really well in Google already for a bunch of stuff. And it's making a bunch of money. So like, I don't really want to screw with it. And so I just left it. And I did think about, like you said, competing against that site with a second site. But no, I went into a totally different vertical. I went into a niche in the automotive industry that was just a hobby of mine, something that I was interested in, something that I wanted to learn more about, and just kind of wanted to share what I was learning.
Wow, that's awesome. So I think you got a taste, I guess, of two different sub niches in the automotive niche. But how were you monetizing your site that you started, that third one? How is it monetized now? Are you able to share any revenue numbers, traffic numbers, anything like that?
Yeah, I can share all of it. So revenue is more or less non-existent because it's not really monetized yet. So this was kind of cool. This is what I liked about the second site is that I kind of saw it as like a little bit of a test. So I put a Zoic on it and I just tested all this other stuff that I knew I didn't really want to do with my third one because it's like, I kind of like, it was like my baby. I wanted to do everything right. I wanted to do everything perfect. So I tested a Zoic with another site. And I actually didn't, I know there's a lot of bad things on Twitter about Zoic. I didn't personally have a bad experience. It was fine. It slowed my site down, but it was fine. I mean, it wasn't bad. It wasn't good. It just was. And so I didn't want to do that with my third site. I knew that it was growing pretty fast. I wasn't that far from Mediavine. I was like, okay, I could probably just wait. I've heard really, really good things about Mediavine. Almost nobody I've found has said bad things about Mediavine. So I'm like, okay, I just need to get this thing to 50,000 sessions a month, and then I'll put display ads. So my main focus and goal this whole time was just to get traffic high enough to do display ads through Mediavine. And I haven't got there yet. I'm at about 20 to 22,000 page views a month right now. So about halfway to Mediavine. And there is a little bit of affiliate income. I think the affiliates made like $60 this month or something, you know, and we're 25 days into May. So, I mean, it's not crazy, but I'm not focused on affiliates at all. I just have some Amazon links throughout the site. So it's not really an affiliate heavy site. It's really, my goal was just display ads.
Was there, a reason you're looking to sell it then before reaching these milestones? Because it looks like you've still got a lot of growth you can kind of pull out of this.
Yeah, I think when I started this site, one of the reasons I was so excited about it was I thought that this could be a seven-figure exit. Like, I started this site, I was very confident. I was like, I'm not selling this site until it's worth seven figures. I was like, this is at least going to be $1 million. And I just, you know, honestly, I know nobody's going to buy the site after I say this, but like, I just think AI is going to destroy the niche site business model for a lot of creators, a lot of sites, and specifically my site. Like, I don't think there's anything really defensible here from an AI perspective. Like, I don't see why, I don't know when it's going to happen, but I'm very concerned that like, when you go into Google and you search for like a keyword that my site answers that drives a lot of traffic, I don't see why Google's Bard can't just give you a response. Like, I think that that's going to be, you know, really, really destructive to niche sites. And I know that there's going to be obviously still SERPs below that. And, you know, I get that. I understand all that, but I'm very pessimistic on the future of niche sites given AI.
Are there topics or keywords you could hit that require more experience and maybe original pictures and how to step-by-step kind of stuff that you could cover that would almost help you there?
Yeah, there definitely is. But what I've also learned is that I love this as a hobby, but I'm not an expert. So it's kind of like, let's just say, I'm trying to think of another example. We'll use cars. It's not cars. So we'll use cars. Like, you love driving cars. You love fast cars. You like doing all that stuff, but you're not an expert on like fixing the cars. Like, you don't know how to actually fix the cars. You just like driving the cars. Like, it's a very similar situation to that for me. And I don't like, I'm not an expert on this topic, and I'm not an expert on all the intricacies of what you need to write about and fix and that kind of stuff, but I'm really passionate about it, but I'm not really interested in learning that kind of stuff. So it's hard. I have to outsource it. And I do own the stuff that the site is about, so I could get original pictures. I do have a lot of original pictures in the site. But it's something that I'm not really interested in like investing that much time or energy in learning. There's other topics that I'm considering going into for a niche site perspective that might not get disrupted by AI as bad.
So does that mean you're potentially looking to make a fourth niche site in a different niche, or are you looking at different topics within that niche site?
Yeah, it would be a different site. It would be a fourth site. Not so fourth site like of mine total, yeah. Not yeah. At the same time. Yeah.
Nice. Are you able to share a little bit of what that niche is, or is that under wraps?
Yeah, so it's just finance investing. Okay. The way I'm thinking about this is I'm trying to think about ways that you can do this without getting disrupted by AI. And I know there are AI videos coming, but I'm wondering if that you can essentially create a niche, and I don't know, this could be an absolutely horrible idea and it could fail, but I'm wondering if you can create an AI site on YouTube, but rather than the content being like written, obviously it's a video. So like, if you go on and I look at some of the keywords that I want to target that have high search volume in Google, there's no, and I put that into YouTube, there's no YouTube videos that have that like specific keyword as a title. And like, it's not optimized for that keyword. So I'm wondering if I can essentially create niche sites on YouTube and use SEO and kind of keyword targeting specifically to do this. And I don't know, it could fail, but finance investing is probably the thing that I'm most passionate about in life. I love learning about money. I love talking about money. I love doing anything with money and investing. So the other topic, the automotive site that I have now, like, I love doing the activity that is related to the niche site, but I don't really like learning about it. I don't know that much about it. So it's kind of difficult for me. I think like when you're really passionate about something, I could think you could do it a lot better.
Yeah. And I definitely think that YouTube idea is a damn good idea too. I mean, I'm trying to branch more and more into YouTube and it. Yeah. I mean, the traction you can get there, I think the audience, because if you're going to have your face on, I think you talked about maybe you're going to do AI once, you might be faceless, but even so, if you have your face on it, like, that trust factor is just like boosted so hard because people are like, oh, this person's actually talking to me, he's a real person. But even those faceless YouTube channels, man, they absolutely crush. And it's just like, even in finance, like Warren Buffett, top Warren Buffett quotes or whatever of all time, you know, stuff like that. And it's just, that's so simple to put together. It might cost you like $50 from a video editor and you could put something like that up.
Yeah, and that's the thing with like my current news site. I don't want my face or my name or anything related to me to be with it, because I'm just not super confident in my knowledge on the topic versus like finance and investing. I feel like I can talk confidently in that. I've done quite a bit in that space. I know a bit, I've read a lot about it, et cetera. So I'm confident in putting my face and my name and my brand behind it. And I think if you can do that, I think you could just have better quality content, whether it's written or video. And I think that that's really like kind of the only way that you're going to be able to defeat AI, is like, they're going to want something from, I'm not saying everybody's going to want something from a human, because I think there's going to be a huge search case, like a use case where people go into Google and use Bard. But for those that actually want a human, like, you're going to have to be able to be there for that. And a lot of people, like my girlfriend specifically, she's like, well, you know, my grandma's not going to use AI. And I'm like, well, that's the point. Like, when you go into Google, you're not even going to know you're using AI. Like, that response, you're just going to, most people are just going to, I think, this is my opinion here, is nobody knows, but like, my opinion is that people are just going to use Google and they're not even going to know it's AI. It's just going to think it's Google to them. They're just going to think the page like format changed a little bit, and they're still just getting their responses, and that's it. Like, they're not going to realize they're actually using AI. And so that's why I think it's going to be so destructive. And so you gotta just find a way that you could be personable and a human and provide that touch that people want.
Yeah. I think a lot of people are kind of going down that road of expanding their traffic outside of Google, using social media, you know, starting to go on YouTube, you know, even talking to you now, like the podcast stuff. Hopefully maybe people start to look to do podcasts, anything that's not your typical Google organic traffic, and just trying to, you know, change that. I mean, there's a lot of people starting to look at, I guess, paid traffic now as well, you know, sending paid traffic to your site for certain pages, or paying for ads on your social media to boost your following on those things too. So there's lots of different, I guess, routes people can go to build their audience and diversify a little, just away from the Google machine and the potential that's coming there. But I think it also depends on the niche, right? Because yeah, automotive, I guess Google could maybe answer some, but you know, if you're asking, you know, how do I fix the skin problem I have? I don't know if Google wants to have the liability of, you know, pulling some essential oil website and telling you to put essential oils on it, and then you get like, I don't know, you have to go to the hospital or emergency room for something, and who's liable for that advice?
Well, you should check out, I've heard a lot of people say the same thing. They're like, well, the medical stuff. And I'm like, well, check out Dr. Gupta. It's Dr. Gupta. I think it's Dr. Gupta .co or .io. I don't know, but it came from My First Million, but check it out. Like, there's a AI doctor, and like, it's really, really good. And so, you know, I don't know what's going to be replaced. I don't know. And that's the thing, is I'm just going to try and have as much fun creating the content as I can, and hopefully that it doesn't get replaced by AI. That's why I'm not focused on the niche sites as much. But like, I'll tell you, one of the sites, or one of the keywords I rank for, let's just say, is like top speed for a Honda Accord. Like, that brings me like almost 2,000 people a month, and like, very easy to rank for. And that's going to be super like replaced by AI. No problem. That's gone. And so I have a lot of content like that on this site. And also, you did mention social media traffic. I have like 13,000 followers on a Facebook page for this.
Dude, that's legit.
Yeah. It's not bad. And then I have a Facebook group that I didn't. So I actually paid for like getting followers on the Facebook page through ads, but I was getting the likes for very, very cheap. John Dykstra taught this from FastStacks. And so I do get some traffic from Facebook, but the Facebook group is like 3,300 people, which I didn't pay for at all. Those are all just organic, which is interesting. What's interesting about this third niche site is that the people that are in this industry, or like specifically interested in this topic, are very, very, very passionate about it. It's like, if you're in England or the UK or, you know, Europe, just in general, I suppose, like if you're a big football fan, like they're super, super passionate about football, right? Or in America, like American football, and people are just super, super passionate about it. And it's the same way for the niche that I'm in. So I thought that there was really good potential, but I am worried about, like I said, AI. So we'll see.
Yeah. No, that's cool that you got that through the Facebook group and Facebook page. That's a bonus for anyone who's looking to buy Robert's site. You get those too. So, I mean, you've got those to leverage as well. But I wanted to dive into as well. You've got real estate stock. I mean, you're diversified everywhere. And there's always a debate around niche websites. Okay, digital assets. Low barrier to entry. It can cost $20 to get started if I wanted to, and I can start writing content. Very high margins, because you don't have to put a lot of capital in. there's not a lot of running costs. Then you get, when you're flipping websites, you get pretty big multiples on top of that. So you can turn a $1,000 website into $30,000 kind of thing. So there's a lot of upside there. And then a lot of people use that to be like, okay, well, I can just stay online. I can just have digital assets. I don't need to do real world assets like real estate or stock market. Real estate, okay, a lot of upfront capital, not much cash flow. You might get some appreciation long term. Stocks, okay, you can go to the stock market, but you know, maybe you have less control over it. I don't know what are the other cons of being in the stock market, like that people usually mention, outside of maybe some stocks tanking and whatever else happening in the world. But maybe from your perspective then, for people who have their niche websites but don't have investments elsewhere or aren't focusing so much on other investments, what are some pros and cons of being in things like real estate and stocks as well as niche websites versus just staying in the digital asset world?
Yeah, so that's one of the most the things you mentioned about the digital asset world is that the returns and the cash flow you can get are just unmatched. Like you're not going to get, I'm not going to be one of those guys that's going to tell you you can get that kind of cash flow or returns from a real estate property, because that's not the case. Like you can make much more money monthly on a digital asset than you can on a rental property or real estate. But here are some of the differences with real estate. Couple things. One, you have really good financing options, and you know, interest rates are high today compared to where they have been in the last couple of years, etc. But just generally speaking, you can go to a bank, put 20% down, and finance 80% of the purchase price. So that's massive. That's huge leverage that you can use to buy an asset for something that you don't have all the money for, right? Like let's just say you put $20,000 down, you can buy a $100,000 asset. Now you own a $100,000 asset for only $20,000. So that's huge leverage that you can put into real estate that can't necessarily do with digital assets. You can get loans to buy digital assets, I understand that. But generally speaking, this is a lot more common and popular in real estate. So that's one thing. Second thing is you can, keeping with that $100,000 example, you can buy a property for $100,000, put $10,000 down as a down payment, and then put maybe another, I'm just using random numbers here, but put $10,000 in renovations, and it could be worth $150,000 after you renovate it. And now what you can do is refinance, get your money back, and now you own a $150,000 asset for $0 out of pocket, which means you own this $150,000, you got this $150,000 asset that you only owe $100,000 on, and you got it for free, essentially. You didn't put any money down. You have to put some work into it, and it's a difficult process. Like, I'm not saying this is an overnight easy thing to do, but it's definitely possible. Happens all the time. You look at any of the real estate guys on Twitter. They're doing it in commercial real estate. They'll buy a self-storage facility. They'll fix it up a little bit. They'll increase the occupancy, increase their rates, increase their NOI. And then they'll do a cash out refi, get all their initial capital back. Now you're into this deal for no money. So now you can't really do that with a digital asset. So that's the other thing. A couple other things, tax advantages for people in the US. So I can't speak to outside the US, but at least in the US, there's tax advantages. You can get bonus depreciation. You can do accelerated depreciation on a year-to-year basis. You can do a 1031 exchange, which means if you make a bunch of money on a property, you can roll that profit into another property and not pay taxes on the profit because you're putting it into a like kind of asset. So 1031 exchanges are great, very complicated. So I'm not going to go into all the intricacies there, but it's definitely something that's available to real estate. And the other thing is when you do buy an asset and you leverage it, to my first point is, you know, I understand using the $100,000 example, you're like, okay, but you still owe $80,000 on that. Which is true, yes, but somebody else is going to pay that off. Let's say you have a 20-year loan. That $80,000 is going to get paid off from somebody else while you rent it out. So you essentially, once this is paid off, you have that $100,000 equity that you didn't pay off, that somebody else paid off for you over time. And in reality, it probably appreciated. So now it may be worth $150,000 or $175,000, depending on how long it was and where a property was, et cetera. And now you own it free and clear and you have all that equity. And these are relatively small numbers. I mean, people do this with $500,000 properties. They do this with $1 million properties. They do this with $2 million properties, $10 million, $50 million. So like it could be done at any scale. I'm just using round numbers here for example. So those are some of the benefits there with real estate. Also, it's relatively stable. I mean, there are obviously bubbles and things can happen, and commercial real estate's in big trouble right now. So like stuff can happen, interest rates, et cetera. Like I get stuff can happen, but it's generally not too catastrophic, and like people need somewhere to live versus with digital assets, things can kind of change overnight and evaporate your entire business. Essentially, it's probably not going to happen as much with real estate. Now, in the stock market side of things, it's entirely passive, 100%. It's like probably the only thing that is entirely passive. And, you know, I'm not talking about being a day trader or picking individual stocks, because if you're a day trader, you're locked into your computer hours a day, you're going to lose money. And so that's not what I'm talking about. And also, not being a stock picker, I don't mind picking stocks, but you have to put hours and hours and hours and hours and hours of research into picking those individual stocks. And so that's not passive. But what Warren Buffett says almost everybody should do for investing is just buy low cost index funds. And that's what I do for the most part. And that's entirely passive. You take the money, you click a couple buttons on your Fidelity account or your Vanguard account, and you never have to touch it again. You just leave it, and it just makes more money for you over time. So that's great. It's super passive. And I know some digital assets can be passive too, but you can make an argument there that they're not super passive. Like buying an index fund is like as close to passive as you can possibly get. The other thing here is that there are massive tax benefits as well. So you have retirement accounts, at least here in the US, you can have traditional IRAs, Roth IRAs, you have 401ks, et cetera. So you have all kinds of, you have HSAs. So you have these awesome retirement accounts and tax advantaged or tax deferred accounts that you can take advantage of with investing in equities that you can't with digital assets per se. So I know that was a long response, but those are some of the pros, cons, et cetera, of real estate, stocks, and digital assets. And I love them all, just to be clear. I love all three. I have all three. I think all three are great, but I don't think any one is the specific answer.
Nice. Oh, that was an in-depth answer too. But with real estate, I've heard different arguments on this, but if you had the money to buy a house in cash, so let's take your $100,000 example, instead of putting, would there ever be a situation where you would buy that in cash, or would you always say put the money down and take the, I guess, a mortgage on the house because that extra $80,000 could be used, for example, to create another digital asset to cash flow? Is there an argument either way?
Yeah, there's definitely you could make an argument either way, and it really depends on the person. So somebody who's going to pay cash, so you kind of look at it this way. The person that is going to pay cash, you're going to have lower risk and higher cash flow. So if you're somebody in a point of life who fits that description, right? Who maybe wants a little bit more cash flow and less risk. Somebody that's probably a little bit older, right? If you're an older person versus somebody who maybe, I don't want to say they're always younger, but maybe they're willing to take more risk. They don't necessarily need the cash flow right now because, you know, they still got a while, they can build up the cash flow, but they're willing, and they don't have a lot of capital, so they're willing to take on a little bit more risk. Somebody would then finance it. But yeah, there's definitely an argument to be made where you just pay cash and you get a lot more cash flow, a lot less risk versus you finance it. You could probably buy 2, 3, 4 properties for that same price because you're not using all the capital in one deal. You're spreading it out over 2, 3, 4 and leveraging it. But that's definitely more risky.
Yeah. Okay. And then as well with the stock market, there's almost a, like you have to have enough money. I guess you can put money in every month, I guess, if you're someone's investment and they're cash flowing, but you need enough money to really get critical mass going where, you know, especially if you're trying to make, I don't know, maybe dividends off your ETFs and stuff like that for it to actually be meaningful. How do you advise someone maybe start if they're looking to put some money into the stock market from their niche website?
Yeah, I mean, if you're trying to get cash flow from the stock market, like that's probably not going to really work. You don't generally look for the stock market for cash flow. Like you said, you can get some ETFs or even individual stocks that pay decent dividends and you could live off that. But like you said, you need a really large sum of money to make that be fairly substantial. Generally speaking, I look for real estate and digital assets for cash flow, and I look at equities, stock market for appreciation. So when I put money into the stock market, I'm not really planning on getting any cash flow right now. I'm really just planning on that appreciating, like let's say to $5 million at some point. And then if I use what's a very common rule, which is the 4% rule, that says you can basically withdraw $200,000 a year from that portfolio and you'll basically essentially never run out of money. So you could live off of $200,000 a year. And that's kind of the cash flow that you get. It's not really cash flow, but it's a withdrawal that you can take once you get to a critical mass.
Okay. Okay. That makes sense. Real estate for cash flow, stock market for appreciation. That's some good rules for people listening who are in the digital asset space there. But I think I've gone through pretty much everything I wanted to ask you, Robert. But I think you need to plug your podcast where people can listen to all the finance stuff you have going on there and everything you've got going on.
Yeah, so just go to theinvestorspodcast.com and you'll see all of our different shows. If you're watching on video, you could see what I look like. You could see which pictures are my shows specifically. If you're not listening on or watching on video and you're just listening, just look for the guy with that sketch that has his hat backwards. That's me. The two shows that are mine are the yellow and green ones, which are called Millennial Investing and Real Estate 101. Also, stay tuned. I might be on YouTube soon. I'm not yet, but I might be soon. So if you're interested, check that out too.
Awesome. Awesome. So yeah, everyone check those out. We'll have them in the description too, so you can get there easily. But thanks for coming on, Robert. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me, James. And also Twitter, if anybody's interested, that's where I'm most active as well. So Twitter. But yeah, James, thanks so much. Thanks so much for having me.
Cheers.